So we have less than 24 hours left for our retreat time together. And I thought I'd explore with you this evening, this afternoon, going home with the aggregates. You will go home with the aggregates. They are really the processes of our life, maybe created by life, these processes. Certainly living life, these processes are living life. They are our human life, and maybe even, probably even other forms of life too. I expect that puppies and kittens have aggregates. And so they really are the kind of, it's life living itself. We can't help but go home with the aggregates. And they're always going on. Whether we are mindful or not, these processes of body and mind tumble on. Even when we're not mindful, we think, we know, we feel, we perceive, we move, we act. There was one point in one retreat where I was sitting in a dining hall and kind of spaced out, you know, just in my world of whatever. And somebody walked into the dining hall and did something and walked out, and somebody else walked into the dining hall, did something and walked out. And then I woke up. Mindfulness returned. And what was interesting in that moment to me was that I remembered that somebody had walked into the dining hall and walked out. Two people had walked in and walked out, only I hadn't been mindful of it at the time. I was mindful of it in retrospect. I woke up and remembered that that had happened. The reason that works is because, as Sayadaw Utejaniya says, the aggregates are doing their job. Perception is perceiving, knowing is knowing, feeling is feeling. Mental formations are forming, whether mindfulness is present or not. And so how does mindfulness fit in? As we've said, I think, a couple of times, it's a mental formation. Mindfulness is a mental formation. It is one of the mental formations that can arise in our minds. And this may be, I don't know for sure, but this may be, mindfulness may be one of the processes that tumbles on that makes us human. This self-reflexive capacity, the ability to know that we know, is apparently not something that all creatures share. And so it's a pretty special capacity, this mindfulness. And what does mindfulness know? What does it recognize? What is it mindful of? Mindfulness mindfuls. What is it mindful of? It's mindful of body. It's mindful of feeling. It's mindful of perceiving. It's mindful of formations, and it's mindful of knowing. It's mindful of this process of body and mind. And so this actually, this recognition of the arising of mindfulness and what mindfulness mindful's about is this already going process. These already going processes of body and mind. And so when mindfulness comes into our awareness, when mindfulness arises, the process of mindfulness appears due to causes and conditions. That's actually one of the great reflections on not self. You know, actually this teaching on not self, which we've referred to now and again, you know, sometimes it feels hard to understand because it so feels like there's a sense of self. And partly it feels like there's a sense of self because we are perceiving things from the perspective of a sense of self. And so because of that belief or perspective of a sense of self, we take in information that confirms that perspective. It's hard to take in information that doesn't confirm that perspective, even when it's staring us in the face. And so this process of mindfulness coming and going is ample evidence for not self. We sit down to meditate. We set our intention to be mindful of the breath or body experience. And what happens? The mind wanders. Did you do that? Did you choose to make the mind wander? Much of the time, it's simply conditions that create the wandering. And even more amazing is when mindfulness returns. Who did that? And so this waking up, the evidence of not self. And we, in that moment of waking up, one of the helpful reflections for me has been mindfulness is waking up. The processes of body and mind are already tumbling on. There's mindfulness is waking up into something that's already happening. So there's nothing to construct when we become mindful. It's already being constructed by these processes. We can simply wake up to what's already happening. What's obvious? The processes are already going. What's obvious? And so these aggregates tumble on, bundle on, heap on. And on occasion, mindfulness is able to be present for that. And so I want to explore with you how that might also be possible at home and not just here on the cushion. We have the capacity for mindfulness to appear any moment of the day. This actually is a really supportive practice in daily life. I find one of the most supportive is just simply to get familiar with this process of mindfulness and begin to recognize the experience of becoming mindful. And as we get familiar with that experience, we start to realize it happens a lot. It actually happens so much more than we consciously recognize. But as we become attuned to the experience of waking up, it's almost as if that becoming attuned begins to help us recognize just how much it happens. And so often, when we become mindful in daily life, there's a very quick movement to do something with what we've become mindful of. We become aware that we're aware of something. And the habit of mind in daily life is to pick that something up and do something with it. We're walking across our house and we see something, a spot on the rug, and mostly we're not aware that we've recognized, oh, I've become aware of something here. Instead, we quickly leap onto that and start doing something. Oh, I need to get something to clean that up with. So just that learning to recognize mindfulness itself, that is recognizing a mental formation arising, and it's a really helpful mental formation to get familiar with. The process of mindfulness in daily life, you know, as we become mindful, as mindfulness arises, as we're driving on the freeway, as we're walking in the grocery store, as we're talking to a friend, as mindfulness re-arises, there's that recognition perhaps of the mindfulness itself, and then often something that the mindfulness recognizes. Very often something, a body experience can be very obvious. The aggregate of body is quite apparent in daily life. Walking down the street, feeling the sensations of movement and temperature, even at a very kind of ordinary level of mindfulness, we can feel body. And so we can connect with body sensation. Body sensations can be obvious as mindfulness arises. Or perhaps we might notice subtle responses of liking or not liking, or even more obvious emotional responses. This is noticing mental formation. And so the practices that many of you are already familiar with in daily life are already observing the aggregates. I think in daily life, probably body experience and mental formations in the form of noticing our emotional life and our thoughts, probably two of the big the areas that are most easily connected with and explored in daily life. But often we can, when we recognize an emotion, maybe just even for a few moments, do a little bit of exploration, investigation of curious, and be curious about what is this emotion related to? Is this emotion of aversion or frustration related to the fact that something unpleasant is going on? And so noticing its relationship to feeling, that can be accessible as we're in the grocery store, pushing a cart that doesn't push very well, feeling the frustration, and then noticing the unpleasantness of a cart that doesn't roll smoothly. Simple, everyday mindfulness that can help us to understand our mental reactions in the moment. Or perhaps a perception. We see how a perception is related to an emotion. Maybe we see a friend in the store, and there's a moment of delight. Oh, a friend. Maybe I'll say hi. And then they turn around, and it's not a friend, it's somebody else, and you don't know that person. And suddenly we realized that that emotion was related to a perception. So again, just pointing to the possibility of exploring these processes right in the midst of our lives. It takes a little bit of intentionality, perhaps, but not, it doesn't have to be a heavy thing. I mean, one thing I often encourage for daily life mindfulness is a light touch. We encourage that here on retreat too, but in daily life, I really emphasize it, because if we like pick up the backpack of mindfulness and pick up the backpack of the aggregates, and it's like, oh, mindfulness, aggregates. Run around looking for the aggregates. It's like, oh, exhaustion. So can it be just the light touch of, oh, mindfulness has come. What's here in this moment? What's obvious now? What's obvious now? Just that light touch. And the mind will wander. The mind will get lost. That's okay. Get familiar with mindfulness returning, and it will have a onward leading impact. We can also sometimes, I've touched into four of the five aggregates in daily life in this description so far, but we can also sometimes touch into the aggregate of knowing, the consciousness that Gil was talking about yesterday and pointing to this morning, that sense of knowing, aware of knowing, aware of awareness. It's accessible in daily life as we become familiar with the experience. For a while, for a long time in my practice, I had no idea what it meant to be aware of the knowing, or have a sense of what somebody meant when they said, are you aware of awareness? And yet, my teachers kept talking about it, and at some point, I began to get intimations, oh, maybe that's what they're talking about. Do you know that you're aware right now? Just that question, do you know that you're aware? Probably if you're even asking that question, the answer is yes, but you may not have a sense of how you know you're aware, or a sense of the experience of knowing awareness. But that's okay. Just the knowing that you're aware is a beginning. And one thing that Sayadaw Tejaniya has says, don't look too hard for it. If you know that you're aware, that's a good place to start. And so it is possible, I've seen in my own practice, as I've gotten familiar with awareness of awareness, to kind of just recognize that in daily life too. It can be a kind of a restful place to go to every now and then. And it is, for many of us, not an obvious thing. And so it's like, it's like, in fact, the looking for it, if you're trying to find it, it'll probably obscure it. Another way or another exploration in daily life, and this in sitting practice in daily life and sitting practice on retreat, a way into exploring the knowing, I found through the kind of one of the first times I really saw a difference between an object and the knowing of the object, was when I was experiencing aversion. And this is something to highlight here, actually. I want to stop and take a moment, because aversion was arising, and within a few moments, through exploring aversion and exploring things around the aversion, the mind understood something new. And so, really, 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 it doesn't matter what we're paying attention to. Any object, even aversion, can be a place where insight arises. So I was paying attention to the aversion and noticing the unpleasantness of it. Okay, aversion, unpleasant. I was noticing that. And then at some point, the mind kind of, for some reason, I don't know why this happened, but the mind decided to recognize aversion is known. And so that became how I was noticing the experience and actually using that language. Aversion is known. Aversion is known. And as the mind recognized that there was knowing happening with the aversion, the mind kind of settled back into the knowing of aversion. The feeling tone of experience shifted quite dramatically, because the feeling tone of knowing is neutral. And so as the mind was exploring aversion itself, there was the strong sense of the unpleasantness of aversion. And as the mind recognized aversion is known, the predominant feeling tone was neutral. That was quite a kind of a revelation to me. Almost it helped me to see or recognize that I was seeing the knowing of that experience. And so these aggregates are accessible to explore right in our daily lives. The aggregate of mental formations, I think, is one of the most potent and interesting of the aggregates to watch and see what happens around it. There's a teaching which we have, I think Gil talked about this, that the aggregate of the sankharas, volitional formations, in the process description, as the texts, the suttas describe each of these aggregates as a process in one particular text. Feeling feels, perceiving perceives, knowing knows. Volitional formations form, or as Gill used the term, constructions. Constructions construct. And so here's the description. I'll just read this to you. The language is a bit funny, but we'll go through it. And why do we call them volitional formations? They construct the conditioned. Therefore, they are called volitional formations. And what is the conditioned that they construct? They construct conditioned form as form. They construct conditioned feeling as feeling. They construct conditioned perception as perception. They construct conditioned volitional formations as volitional formations. They construct conditioned consciousness as consciousness. They construct the conditioned, therefore they are called volitional formations. This aggregate of the volitional formations, this constructing form, this constructing aggregate, constructs all the aggregates. And so as we watch the constructing process at work, we see its impact on all of our experience. For example, the volitional formation, emotion as a volitional formation of anger. Anger arising in the mind. Often constructs an expression of tightness and harshness on the face. It really often constructs an unpleasant feeling. The way the mind perceives is conditioned by that anger. What the mind recognizes. We might tend to see experience, perceive experience through this lens of anger. For instance, as we look out at the world when we are angry, we may tend to see or perceive things as being hostile to us. Someone's expression, maybe somebody has a little gas and a little flit of expression crosses their face, and we perceive it as antagonistic or hostile to us because of our filter of anger. Our consciousness, what we know, is conditioned by anger. What we take in. This is As I said kind of earlier about mindfulness, when we and about the sense of self, you know, that when we are perceiving through the sense of self, we don't take in information to the contrary. And kind of likewise, when we're angry, we tend to take in information. We may not even see something that is contrary to that anger. So that mental formation conditions what we know, actually what our consciousness will receive. And anger tends to condition and construct more anger. So this kind of recognition, the teaching around how the volitional formations construct all the aggregates, is a really subordinate thing to recognize in our daily lives. Because again, we begin to understand the conditioned nature of our experience, the conditioned nature of our reactions, the conditioned nature of how we're perceiving things, as opposed to simply believing what we are taking in as being an accurate representation of reality. So sankharas as constructors. Emotions construct our experience. That's a kind of clear way to see that. Views, beliefs, ideas are also volitional formations. They also are constructors of our experience. Some of these views come from our personal conditioning, from our own kind of navigation through the world. And some of these views come from cultural conditioning. culture could potentially be seen as a set of shared views, beliefs, kind of collective mental formations. In a environment where we are trained to have certain beliefs, the people around us have a shared set of beliefs, and they pass those on to us through culture, it becomes hard to recognize those beliefs as beliefs because the people that we mostly hang out with share those beliefs. So it becomes more like just truth or just what's right or what's normal. I'm thinking about that elephant and the blind people. If 20 of the blind people had been shown the leg and one had been shown the tail, and then they started describing what their experience was like, probably that one person who said it was like a broom might start to think they were kind of crazy. Everybody else says it's like a post. What's wrong with me? And so sometimes those cultural formations, those formations that we take in because of or from our culture, we each have them individually. Those formations in our mind, and we carry them around with us individually, but they're shared, and so harder to see as conditioned, constructed. So much suffering comes from this kind of shared delusion, basically, believing a perspective to be truth. For many white Americans, African American men are perceived as frightening. It seems particularly in this time, so many of our white policemen perceive African American men as frightening. And so there is this additional piece of not only a culture that shares a perspective, but a culture that shares a perspective and has the power to enforce it leads to so much suffering in our world. You don't have to look very far to find many examples of this kind of thing happening all over the world. In exploring these constructions, so far, the constructions I've been talking about have largely been what we might call challenging or reactive or delusional constructions. And these five aggregates are the unfolding of our experience both in the realm of our habitual and reactive and in the realm of the skillful and responsive. As Gail reminded us this morning, love, compassion, our mental formations, they too arise and condition, construct the other aggregates. Love arises. The face is often suffused with delight, softness. The feeling of metta itself often has a pleasant quality. The unconstricted heart, the heart that opens to the world, that quality of not being tight around what's coming in, that has a pleasant quality. And yet, still, even with that, that heart, that open heart, will receive without constriction, will receive the impressions of the world, will receive the pain of the world, and resonate in tune with that. And so this feeling of the experience of love as it meets, this experience of the unconstricted heart as it meets suffering, constructs compassion. This experience of this unconstricted heart as it meets someone who's experiencing delight or joy resonates with the sympathetic joy, constructs that sympathetic joy. The feeling with metta can have flavors of pleasant and unpleasant, depending on what that open heart is resonating in tune with. And we perceive through the lens of love. As I was thinking about this beforehand, I was thinking it was easiest in a way to contrast it with the lens of anger. That when I'm perceiving through the lens of anger, I tend to perceive other people as potentially hostile or unfriendly or distant. And when I'm perceiving through the lens of open-heartedness, I perceive lots of connection, friendliness in the world. When I feel love in my heart, I get a lot of smiles in the world. And so that's the other thing I think I didn't just thought of this. It's like that experience of love doesn't only construct these aggregates, it has an impact on other aggregates as well. And I think, too, the thing is, I was thinking about this contrast between perceiving through anger and perceiving through love, you know, seeing the world. I was thinking about the knowing. And I was realizing that when I'm angry, I'm kind of in my own, like, little world, my own little bubble. If I've got a kind of a snit going and I'm in the grocery store, I probably don't even see people. You know, I'm just in my own little world. I'm just ignorant of what other people are doing and what's happening. When my heart is open, people are there. I'm aware. I'm knowing, recognizing that people actually exist. And so we can also explore these beautiful qualities, so many skillful constructions that are possible to arise. Love, joy, compassion, generosity, equanimity, tranquility, calm, peace, faith, patience, mindfulness, concentration. They all have a wholesome, constructing impact on our experience. And we can see that when they arise. And knowing that they have a wholesome impact on our experience, we can also choose, because choice is a process available in our human minds, we can choose to create the conditions to cultivate these wholesome qualities. We can choose to align our intention with cultivating mindfulness, cultivating love, cultivating generosity, even if we're not feeling it in the moment. This is one of the powerful things about this constructing aggregate, that even if the for instance, if we're interested in constructing, if we're interested in creating, cultivating patience, even if we're not feeling patient, if we're not feeling patient, but we're interested in moving in the direction of patience, we can use the aggregate of the mental formations, the intention to direct the mind and body towards patience, and use the body to behave patiently. This combination of intention and action is very powerful, constructing capacity for wholesome qualities. I was exploring just this very thing, this very question of impatience. One day, I was in a drugstore, and I was impatient. I had, things to do. I was rushing. I was going through the store pretty quickly, and I felt the impatience. And I think I noticed it, because I noticed myself throwing things into the basket. So there, it's like, okay, this is pretty obvious. So the body, this is a way the impatience-conditioned body. It conditioned the kind of reactive, the movement, the quick movement of throwing things into the basket. And so the kind of practice I picked up in that moment was to see, now this is the fine line. It's like, often we think, okay, if I'm going to behave patiently, I need to repress that impatience. And that's not the practice. It's not that actually doesn't seem to be very helpful, because that repression itself has an aversive, unwholesome quality to it. And so the thing that I explored was like, okay, there's impatience here. Yes, I feel that leg tumbling forward. I feel the mind like wanting to rush. I already feel it's already out the door and in my car. But here I am in the store. Can I feel that tumbling forward and yet not let it leak out into my body? And so through a conscious intention to cultivate patience, our body is actually pretty amenable to choice. I can choose to slow down my actions, which is what I did. I slowed down my actions. I picked things up from the shelf slowly, as if I was really calm and very patient, and I put them in my basket, all while feeling the impatience. So we can choose to engage with our bodies in a certain way while we don't necessarily have that capacity to just say to our minds, oh, impatience is arising. May patience arise instead. We don't often have that kind of control of our minds. And yet we do have some say over how our bodies behave in the world. And so what I discovered as I explored that, not repressing the impatience, but fully allowing it, and there was very much the sense of, ooh, let's see if I can not let it leak out through the pores of my skin. Within about a minute, that impatience just dissipated, and it was replaced with patience. Now, this was not a very intense impatience, you know, so I'm not saying that this is always going to happen when you do it. And yet, it is something that we can explore. There's a text called the Atakavaka. It's kind of an old text. It's understood by most scholars or many scholars to be one of the early, actually both early teaching in the teachings Buddha, in the Buddhist teaching career, and also kind of untouched by subsequent edits. So it's got a different kind of flavor to it, this text, and it has a couple different themes to it. It's kind of basically it's a set of 16 poems, and they're poems about clinging and poems about what it's like to cling and what it's like to be free of clinging. So it's got poems that describe what it's like to be stuck and caught in clinging, and poems that describe what it's like when somebody is free from clinging. And then the third type of poem is, and what does somebody do to go from one to the other? It's got some training poems in there too. How does one become free? How does one become awakened? And the kind of one of the striking things about those set of poems, that set of training poems, is that they very much model, in a way, the language of the poems that describe someone who's awake. The language of the poems who describe someone who's awake say it describes the behavior of that person. It says that person is kind, that person is not reactive, that person is generous, that person goes on, describing different qualities. That person is peaceful, that person is not prone to argument and quarrels. And then in the training texts, it says one should basically kind of like one should try to be peaceful. One should not engage in quarrels. One should. So it's basically the description of the training is to model the description, model the behavior of someone who's free. And I think it happens through this point of intention that actually works. That through the engagement, maybe I can behave patiently, even while feeling impatience. In that behaving patiently, there is an intention to cultivate the quality of patience and not express the quality of impatience. Both of those supports the letting go of the impatience and the strengthening of the patience. And so we can use this. If you want to be peaceful, act peacefully. And be truthful about non-peacefulness inside. Be open to recognizing that too is there. That seems like enough. Let's sit for a moment.